Thursday is the first day of spring, which means the crocuses are up, the kites are out, and the sabzi polo is ready for the oven. That's the rice served during Nowruz. The New Year's holiday originated in Persia. Today it's celebrated in many countries, from Afghanistan to Uzbekistan. It starts at the exact minute of the vernal equinox, when the sun crosses the equator and the seasons change. Weekend Edition food commentator Bonnie Wolf sees the megawatt celebration as the spring festival that sets the standard.
For the last 3,000 years or so, Persians have welcomed spring with a 13-day party honoring new life and the new year. Nowruz has it all. There's myth and symbolism. There's fragrant hyacinth and Persian poetry. There are magic numbers and magic puddings. The traditional Nowruz table is covered with a special cloth on which sit seven symbols of renewal. Everything comes in sevens. It's a magic number. Wild olives are love, apples stand for beauty, and sumac means fertility. Preparations for Nowruz start weeks in advance with a thorough house cleaning, new clothes, and the germinating of seeds to represent rebirth.
What a beautiful house.
Thank you.
Just lovely.
Shall I offer you some tea?
I would love some tea. Thank you.
Okay.
For a peek at the real thing, I visited Najmia Batmanglij at her home in Washington, D.C. Najmia grew up in Iran and has written many Persian cookbooks. The latest is called Happy Nowruz, Cooking with Children to Celebrate the Persian New Year. I knew I was at the right house because on her door hangs a wreath decorated with tulips and daffodils and eggshells with sprouts coming out of them. Her airy home is filled with more flowers, more sprouts, and the scent of hyacinth and baklava. I love this holiday. During the Islamic Revolution in 1979, when she was pregnant with the first of her two sons, Najmia and her husband fled Iran. But she did not leave behind her passion for Persian culture. As she cooks in her large, sunny kitchen, she talks about why it is so important for Persians to celebrate Nowruz wherever they are.
I wanted my children to respect their heritage, and their ancient heritage. I think it's very important. Even though they were born or raised here, never been in Iran, and I want Iran to be associated with good things, with saffron, rose water, orange peel rather than other things.
Najmia says a spring New Year makes perfect sense.
It's a natural New Year, you know that. First of all, it's springtime, all this smell of flowers. Everybody's happy. There's a lot of light and sunshine. There's no snow, and everything is clean. One of the ritual of the Nowruz, actually, is besides house cleaning, physically, you house clean mentally. Cleansing your spirit is very important. You forgive oneself and others for wrongdoing. I think that's a very good idea.
The holiday this year begins Thursday at exactly 1:48 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Najmia says Persians believe the mood you set at this transition continues throughout the year. So a few hours before, family and friends gather around the Nowruz table, make wishes, read poems, and meditate. Then there's hugging and kissing, and they start to eat. First, a soup with noodles that symbolize unraveling the difficulties in the year to come. It's cooked with fresh dill, parsley, and 4 pounds of spinach, then garnished with dry mint and turmeric.
It's so fresh. It just is so green tasting.
Taste of spring, huh?
Absolutely. It does. It tastes just like spring.
There's a bowl filled with 7 kind of nuts and dried fruits. And there are 7 different sweets. Tiny marzipan berries with a sliver of pistachio for stems. Honey almond crunch with saffron. Rice cookies with poppy seeds. Clover leaf-shaped chickpea cookies with cardamom. And baklava from the gods.
I'm going to take off the baklava. And I'm going to put the syrup on it while it's hot. Because it's very important. Mix it. Honey and rose water. And put it there. And I usually design it with pistachio and rose petals. That's my signature.
For the big family feast, Najmia usually has 20 to 30 guests and serves the same menu every year. For our test lunch, she made melt-in-your-mouth breaded catfish sticks marinated in lime juice and turmeric. She stuffed a whole smoked whitefish with garlic and slices of Seville orange, then baked it for an hour. We also had herb cuckoo made with a dozen eggs, a fertility symbol, and about 6 cups of herbs representing spring. The green, green omelet was topped with garnet-colored barberries. I totally understand why this holiday has lasted for thousands of years.
When the revolution came in 79, the Islamic Republic frowned upon Nowruz. But that was, there was interesting things. This was Iranian people. It was sort of resisting. They celebrate Nowruz more than ever. Politics changes, but culture stays forever. That's my...
For NPR News, I'm Bonnie Wolf.
Haji Firuz is here.
You can find a recipe for fresh herb cuckoo at npr.org/books.
Nowruz is here. It's once a year. It's once a year.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
From television to radio and a new memoir, John Gorman has written a personal history of one radio station. WMMS in Cleveland used to be the hottest station in one of the hottest radio towns in the country. WMMS was known as the Buzzard, and as program director, Gorman made the Buzzard soar back in the 70s and early 80s. From member station WKSU, Vivian Goodman reports.
It all started in Cleveland with the legendary Alan Freed.
Hello, Moondoggers. How are y'all? This is Alan Freed, the king of the Moondoggers, and welcome again to another of your favorite blues, rhythm, and jazz rock and roll parties.
Freed's show started rock in Cleveland the minute it went on the air in 1951. Mike Olszewski was just a kid then. Today, he's a radio news reporter. He remembers when Cleveland was the nation's eighth biggest city. Then the steel mill started shutting down.
And it was almost a dead Rust Belt city by 70 or 71. The one thing that young Cleveland had to grab onto was music. They had great radio, great music, and that's all we had to hang on to because the sports teams weren't doing anything, and the political scene was just so divisive that people just gave up on the city, except for radio.
In 1968, the Federal Communications Commission decreed that co-owned AM and FM stations in the same market had to have separate formats. At first, FM was just an afterthought. Then the big three automakers started putting receivers in cars. The conditions were right for Boston programmer John Gorman to make the move to Cleveland in 1973. Gorman assembled a crew of college radio DJs and turned them loose on 100.7 FM.
Hi, everybody. This is Huey Lewis, and you're listening to my personal friend, Kid Leo, on WMMS.
You'll get the songs you want, 'cause we're MMS.
In his memoir, John Gorman recalls driving through the city, listening to Bob Dylan.
And the only sound that's left after the ambulances go, it's Cinderella sweeping up on Desolation Row.
And that's how Gorman came up with the station's logo, a wild-eyed turkey vulture with a mohawk and an attitude.
And it's just like, well, what else do you expect to see flying over a dying city?
The popular T-shirt at the time read, Cleveland, you gotta be tough. Once the Buzzard swooped in, its image was everywhere. But Gorman says it took a while for advertisers to catch on.
Leather shops and cool clothing stores and record stores, those were the only clients that would advertise on the station. Our sales department could not get into the major agencies. There are agencies in Cleveland that didn't even want them sitting in the lobby because they had longer hair and was slightly different and all that. And, you know, these are very conservative times. We're talking about 1973 going into 74. And, you know, we're considered somewhat radical, actually very radical.
The ad sales soared when the ratings did. August 9th, 1978, Bruce Springsteen gives a free show at the Cleveland Agora, sponsored by WMMS.
I'd like to thank Cleveland for supporting us like it was one of the first towns when we came in. When we first came here, we got some respect.
Stephen Van Zandt was playing in Springsteen's E Street Band at the time.
People would say to us, you know, what's your favorite town? What's your favorite rock and roll town? And we'd say Cleveland, and people thought we were kidding. You know, it would be like a laugh line, but we weren't kidding.
He wasn't alone. Mott the Hoople's Ian Hunter says before leaving on its first American tour, the British band thought it would find the hippest scenes on the coasts.
But then when you got here, New York was quite We found it rather backward musically, and we also found L.A. rather backward musically. And when we got to Cleveland, we found they were picking up on people like Bowie and Roxy Music and ourselves long before the coast.
Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah.
They broke Mott the Hoople.
Steve Popovich was doing A&R for Epic Records back then, and he says WMMS was a station where he could test new bands.
Every label at that time, any project that was to the left and it fit what John was doing at MMS, you'd put it out, and if the city of Cleveland, if people responded the next day at retail, you knew you had something that would work everywhere.
He was a boy from the street.
Long before Marty Jones released her debut LP in 1985, she listened to The Buzzard growing up in Northeast Ohio and says it was a big influence.
Huge. I remember listening every morning when I got up before school. And sometimes I would go to the record store, which would be the Quonset Hut in Canton. Sometimes looking for records that they didn't even have yet. And it was so impressive that, you know, we got the heads up on him from WMMS that we'd have to wait till they came out.
Jones is back in the Cleveland area, raising a family with her husband, producer Don Dixon. They're often in a recording studio with Heartland rocker Michael Stanley, now a classic rock DJ in his hometown. He says his station can't even come close to the audience WMMS had.
Last book, we pulled in like an 8-share, and everyone was giddy with excitement. And I think at one point, MMS had something like a 33 share or something like that, which is inconceivable. It's like every dogs were listening. Everybody was listening.
Steven Van Zandt is a DJ, too, now, on Sirius Satellite Radio. He just wishes the old WMMS was still around.
We'd go in there whenever we were in town and just start playing records with whoever the DJ was on duty at that moment. I mean, it was completely informal. This was the height of the rock era, and the rock era ended.
Today, WMMS is owned by Clear Channel, and The Buzzard has been grounded. For NPR News, I'm Vivian Goodman in Cleveland.
The new novel, Mudbound, is a story of racism and well-kept secrets set on a desolate farm in the Mississippi Delta at the end of World War II. It explores the complex relations between two families, the owners of the land and the sharecroppers who live and work on it. It's Hillary Jordan's first novel, and it earned her the Bellwether Prize for Fiction. That's an award founded by the writer Barbara Kingsolver to promote literature of social responsibility. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Barbara Kingsolver doesn't know exactly when or why it happened, but she's sure of one thing. Literature about social change has fallen out of favor in this country. Books like Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath or Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird were once held up for praise, but now, Kingsolver says, works with a moral center and a political message are looked down on as too earnest.
When artists do write social critique, however artfully, we are somehow expected to apologize for that, or at least to justify our choice of political content. You know, interviewers often say, well, now, isn't this political? Heck yes.
That's why Kingsolver established the Bellwether Prize, which is given biannually to an unpublished author who not only wins a cash prize, but also a guaranteed publishing contract. Mudbound, says Kingsolver, is a beautifully written novel that examines the roots of racism through the distinct voices of its characters.
I love the voices of the novel. I love that you understand everybody, even though everyone isn't right. And in the long run, some people are very wrong. But you begin by feeling their own perspective, and you have some sympathy for every character.
Hillary Jordan says Mudbound was inspired by her mother's family stories of the year they spent on an isolated farm without running water or electricity. Eventually, it grew into a larger story with darker themes. But the first character she wrote about, Laura, was based on her own grandmother.
I started out writing what I thought was going to be a short story in the voice of Laura. And as the story grew, I just found myself wanting to hear from other people. as the story got larger, as it embraced these other themes, these larger themes about war and about Jim Crow, I wanted to hear from those people.
There is no omniscient narrator in this story. Instead, it's told from the perspective of six characters, black and white, male and female. Henry buys the farm and moves his unsuspecting family there. His brother Jamie, just home from the war, joins them. Laura, Henry's wife, is a city girl who cannot believe where she now lives, the dreary farm she calls Mudbound.
When I think of the farm, I think of mud. Limbing my husband's fingernails and encrusting the children's knees and hair, sucking at my feet like a greedy newborn on the breast, marching in boot-shaped patches across the plank floors of the house. There was no defeating it. The mud coated everything. I dreamed in brown.
Hap and Florence are the black sharecroppers on the farm. Their son Ronsel is a proud World War II veteran. On his first day back, a nasty confrontation with racists at a local store reminds him of what he left behind when he went to war.
Jimmy would have been proud of me that day at Tricklebanks, but my daddy would have blistered my ears. All he knew was the Delta. He'd never walked down the street with his head held high, much less had folks lined up on either side cheering him and throwing flowers at him. The battles he'd fought were the kind nobody cheers you for winning, against sore feet and aching bones, too little rain or too much, heat and cotton worms and buried rocks that could break the blade of a plow. Ain't never a lull or a ceasefire.
Finding the voices and making them sound authentic was difficult, Jordan says. She did a lot of research to find the voice of her black characters. Even so, she says it was a daunting task.
I had a number of well-meaning friends say things to me like, even Faulkner didn't write about black people in the first person. But, you know, ultimately I just decided that it was so important to let my black characters address the ugliness of Jim Crow themselves in their own voices.
One friend who supported her decision was fellow writer James Canyon, who read the book as Jordan was writing it.
She was looking for a compelling and convincing way of telling her novel, and that meant including everybody, letting everybody speak, black and white, male and female. Otherwise, it would be like a one-sided story.
Did you ever have conversations about whether, you know, African-American readers might not accept the way that she was interpreting these voices?
Yeah, and of course I was always concerned. Hillary is as white as you can be. And to write in the voice of a black person from the South, it is definitely a challenge. It is a little risky, but she had no choice. But rather a challenge. And she went for it, you know, and she did it.
At first, Jordan says she just wanted to write a page-turner and only gradually realized she was writing a book that had something to say about our society.
I really tried never to let the message get in the way of the story. I mean, ultimately, this book is about those six people and about their lives and about what happened to them in this very brutal time in which they were living. And it's also about forbidden love and betrayal and murder and some of the really juicy stuff.
The stories Jordan heard about the family farm when she was growing up were mostly charming and funny. It was only in researching the book that she came to understand they were also stories of survival and that the lessons to be learned about the consequences of racism deserved to be told again and again. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read about finding a slave's grave in an excerpt of Hillary Jordan's new novel at npr.org/books.
From Sin City to 100 Bullets, noir comics are about all things dark and shady. The books steer you down dim alleys into a crime boss's seedy lair. Inside, it's shadows and mystery, plus a lot of guns, sex, and car chases. Oh, and of course, a brooding detective or tragic superhero. Now a seasoned illustrator is pulling back the curtain on this dark art. Sean Martin Bro's new book is How to Draw Noir Comics, The Art and Technique of Visual Storytelling. How you doing?
Hi, Farai. Doing very well. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, there's so many different genres of comics, manga, graphic novels. What exactly is a noir comic?
I guess for me, it's more of like my style. I guess it's the way I approach any story. So if I get hired to draw a superhero comic book, like let's say Batman, or if it's like a regular detective story with people with no powers or no abilities, it's just the way I tend to draw the images, you know, and I kind of give them a dark, shadowy, kind of dramatic look the way I draw it.
Give us a sense of the variety of projects that you've worked on.
Worked on Batman Detective Comics. I've done a series called Angel Town for Vertigo DC. I've done Morlocks. It was an X-Men spinoff from Marvel. I've done a bunch of different projects here and there, and I've done a lot of illustration work in like the mainstream arena, like editorial illustration for magazines like Vibe or Black Enterprise.
Now, comics, manga, and graphic novels are hot not just as things in themselves, but also as movie properties. We mentioned Sin City. There was a movie that doesn't even seem to have a comic book link, the 2002 Tom Hanks movie Road to Perdition, but it is linked to a graphic novel or a series, Lone Wolf and Cub, you know, Batman, Spider-Man. Why is this form of art and storytelling getting so much heat in a good way from the studios?
Because the studios can see they can make money from it. I mean, because like this is the way the studios work.
That's a good start.
Yeah, I mean, the way they work is that they tend to go for established properties. And so the same way they've always adapted novels, they see graphic novels as another medium that they can adapt. So these same stories have been around for like generations. I mean, I've grown up reading comics. I'm 36 years old. And so it's really funny to see the X-Men now as like a brand new hot property. But I'm like, there are decades of stories there that have been around for a while. So they're just really just seeing, oh, okay, we can make some money off of this.
Are you making any moves into doing film work as well?
Yeah, actually, I started a production company called Verge Entertainment back in 2001 with two partners of mine, Joseph Illich and Milo Stone. And it really is just another extension of my telling a story. You know, I mean, as a comic book artist, I tell a story from panel to panel. And so segueing into film just seems so organic, you know. So, you know, you tell a story with panels, and then you tell a film with frames. And so that basically just sort of translating that storytelling from two-dimensional art board to three-dimensional actors is just, it's just such a thrill to do.
Now, when you decided to write a book about technique and a book that was, I mean, you know, on a personal level, my grandfather used to draw comics, you know, just for the family. It was one of the things he loved, and he had all these technique books around. But, you know, who do you think your audience really is? Who's going to pick up a book about how to draw comics, and who do you think the people are that are taking this to heart?
You know, it's interesting because I always thought that it would primarily be people that are already comic book artists that maybe wanted to try a different style or have gravitated to this more dramatic type of style. But I've gotten people who have read my book that said, you know what, I've had a passing interest in art, but just the way you explain your technique and the way you approach it, they find it fascinating. And also, I get this all the time from people that have kids or younger family members that are into art, that are into comics, but just need a little direction or some tips on how to get into the industry and how to survive the industry, or just how to just, you know, hone their talent to survive in it. You know, that to me is very gratifying to see people saying, wow, you know what, I bought this for a family member, but I'm getting a lot of stuff out of it myself.
If you have to think about where comics are going in the future, there's been a whole slew of books talking about how comics fared during the sort of Cold War era and were seen as unpatriotic in some ways and arguably dumbed down a little bit. Now you're seeing a lot more adult-themed comics and graphic novels. Do you think that trend's going to continue?
Well, I think comic books have always gotten a sort of a bum rap as being dumbed down. You know, I think there have always been quality stories that adults, like my dad used to read all of my comic books back in the 80s. I mean, he would like read all of my X-Men. He would, you know, be into all of these different types of comics that were really well written. I mean, you know, these are adults writing comics. So it's not like you got like a 5-year-old writing like a comic book. So I think the sophistication has always been there. And so, of course, you're going to have some books that tend to be more about, you know, fighting and action. But there are so many more that are dealing with real characters, real character arcs, real themes, you know, especially a lot of socially relevant themes. So I think they've always, it's always been there. Now that the spotlight is really focusing on the industry, people are saying, oh, wait a minute, this isn't all about men in tights.
All right. Well, Sean, on that note, I guess that we'll have to go out and find our own men in tights here in Los Angeles. Thank
and
you.
Women, so, and women.
And women in tights. Thanks a lot, Sean.
Thank you so much.
Sean Martin Bro's new book is How to Draw Noir Comics, The Art and Technique of Visual Storytelling. He joined me from our NPR studios in Washington, D.C.
Okay, the movie Bring It On was a comedy about the rough and tumble world of competitive cheerleading.
You are cheerleaders. Cheerleaders are dancers who have gone retarded.
Oh my! There were rivalries!
When you go to nationals, bring it. That way, when we beat you, we'll know it's because we're better.
I'll bring it. Don't worry.
It exposed coaches who obsess over looks, styles, and scales.
In cheerleading, we throw people in the air, and fat people don't go as high.
And of course, thrilling, tumbling, turning, throwing, and cheering.
Ready, girls? I said,
burn! It's cold in here. I said there must be some toros in the atmosphere.
The weird thing, it wasn't that far off from reality. As a journalist found out after spending a year and a half following competitive college cheerleaders, Kate Torgovic. Torgovinic?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Thank you, Torgovinic. Has a new book out called Cheer, Three Teams on a Quest for College Cheerleading's Ultimate Prize. Kate, welcome to the Bryant Park Project.
Thanks so much for having me.
You write a little bit about the mythology of the cheerleader in American culture. It's interesting that it started out as an all-male pursuit, right?
Yes, it started out as all guys in 1898 at the first Princeton versus Rutgers game. And it wasn't actually until World War II when women started going into factories and all these previously male spaces that female cheerleaders became the norm.
Now, when did it morph really into girls in pretty outfits and short skirts? When did that
become a little sexier?
Yeah,
that was around the 1950s. And a lot of those things go back to one guy named Lawrence Herkimer, who's sort of the grandfather of cheerleading. He invented the pleated skirt. He invented the pom-pom, the spirit stick. A lot of the things we think of as very cheerleader.
And the rest is history. You have this great line sort of about America's romanticism with cheerleaders. Could you read that little quick passage from your book?
Sure. Our common knowledge understanding of cheerleaders is dramatically at odds with the reality. In American culture, we give athletes the utmost respect, but most of us, even the ones familiar with competitive cheerleading, don't acknowledge that cheerleaders are athletes. It's a rift intricately tied to cheerleading's evolution.
Now, part of the evolution of cheerleading is the result of things like gymnastics programs getting cut. Tell us a little bit about when cheerleading went from go raw team to I'm a big man and I'm about to throw this little tiny woman 20 feet in the air and then catch her by her ankles.
Sure. It was actually in the very early 1980s. In 1981, there was the first cheerleading competition for high school teams. They brought in all these teams to SeaWorld, actually. That's where it was held. And at the same time, gymnastics programs at schools were getting shut down left and right. People were worried about insurance costs, poor coaching. And so you had a lot of gymnasts going into cheerleading. And those two things together, the competitive and the gymnast being involved, it's just snowballed into what we see today.
But it's interesting, though, on the college level, cheerleading is classified as an activity, not a sport. So it's not really governed by the NCAA, the College Athletic Association. So the fact that it's classified as an activity versus a sport, how does that affect the rules that govern cheerleading?
Well, there aren't a ton of rules that govern cheerleading. There's many different organizations making the rules, and you don't have sort of blanket things like a four-year eligibility rule. So it's not uncommon to talk to a cheerleader at the top level who's been cheering in college for 5, 6, 7 years and cheer. There's actually one guy who's starting his 8th year as a college cheerleader.
It's amazing. Some of the behind-the-scenes information you give, really a little bit stunning. Because it has become so athletic, whether or not it's recognized as being athletic, some of the statistics on injuries about cheerleaders, can you just give us a gee whiz bang statistic that blew
sure.
your mind?
Well, every year about 25,000 cheerleaders will end up in an emergency room, from everything to an injured hand to maybe a head, neck, or back injury. However, we are talking about 4 million people, so that comes down to about 6 out of every 1,000 cheerleaders who's going to be injured in a given year.
And they also, there's self-inflicted injury. I have to imagine that eating disorders are an issue because cheerleaders, if they're going to be thrown around, they want to be light. But as one male cheerleader you spoke to said, I'd rather have a strong cheerleader than a light one. Can you explain what's going on there?
Sure. There's a lot of focus on being very thin and being very small in this world because you are being thrown in the air and part of your job description is to wear a pretty skimpy uniform. So you do see eating disorders. They're not hugely, hugely, hugely common, but it does happen. And there is one girl in cheer who's very upfront about being bulimic. There's another who's very upfront that she had a cocaine addiction that sort of got started to lose weight for cheerleading. But when you talk to people, they sort of tell you that it's about muscle control. It's about being able to control your body, being able to squeeze every single muscle so you're very easy to move around in the air, that that's what really makes a good cheerleader versus just being naturally very small.
Now, in the world of competitive cheerleading, a lot of guys, obviously, because they are, it's not just the women throwing each other around, the guys who are often the base when they make those giant formations. Who are these guys? I mean, are they guys who were on the wrestling team and got hurt, or football players who weren't big enough once they got to college?
Absolutely. And it's really interesting. At the college level, 50% of cheerleaders are actually guys. Most teams will have more guys than they will women. And yeah, exactly. They come from football. They come from wrestling. They come from baseball. Maybe they didn't get the scholarship they were hoping for in college, or they had an injury that took them out of their first sport. And every guy cheerleader, if you ask them how you got into this, they say for a girl. It was someone they were dating, or they're in the weight room and a group of girls came up and was like, why don't you come to cheerleading practice today? And that's sort of how they get into it. And it's just very addictive from the beginning.
I'm curious, what do the young women that you talk to and men think about professional cheerleaders?
You know, it's really interesting. Professional cheerleaders are very different. They dance. It's much more of a dance. There's pom-poms, different types of uniforms. So when you're done with college, you're sort of done. We are starting to see a few professional sports teams, started with the Denver Nuggets, having stunting cheerleaders who go in the air and do these acrobatic moves.
We're speaking with Kate Turgovinek. She has a new book out called Cheer, Three Teams on a Quest for College Cheerleading's Ultimate Prize. And you decided to focus on three different teams from three different schools. You had the University of Memphis All-Girl Tigers, Southern University Jaguars, and Stephen F. Austin Lumberjacks, which you describe as the Yale of cheerleaders. Why did you decide on these three different schools? I mean, they all have very different profiles.
And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to give a very broad view of what the cheer world is. I settled on Stephen F. Austin because they're the best of the best. They're constantly creating new pyramids, new moves. I wanted to make sure to get a really great all-girl squad because that's somewhere where you're seeing a lot of evolution in cheerleading. And then for Southern, I wanted something different. They're historically black college in Baton Rouge, and they sort of come about in different ways. And actually, their coach describes them as both teams and Bring It On rolled into one.
When you went into this, you originally were a reporter for Jane Magazine, and you did a shorter article about this. And you're pretty upfront about you kind of had some preconceived notions about cheerleaders and cheerleading going into this. When you went into this, what did you expect to find, and what changed your mind?
Well, first of all, I wasn't a cheerleader, and like most people listening right now, I thought cheerleading was kind of silly. I thought it was waving pom-poms and yelling rah, 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 and, you know, dating a quarterback maybe. And when I went in, I just started to see such intensity and such passion that it just sort of really pulls you in. And people were talking about tryouts where 150 people were going for three spots. They're talking about national championships that they lost by a hundredth of a point. And there's just this fierceness and this toughness to cheerleaders that I find very inspiring.
Why do they do it?
Some people will tell you that they love the risk, actually, that the thrill, the adrenaline rush they get from that is what they love. Some people will tell you it's for the friendships, that they have sort of fraternities-type things that develop and they're friends 30 years out. And a lot of them love sports, and so it's a very natural thing for them to sit there and cheer for sports.
Now, do these cheerleaders, do they actually still cheer at games? Do they go on and cheer other athletes, or are they on their own track of we're our own thing and we're out here to compete for ourselves? I don't have time to be at the football game on Saturday.
Cheerleaders sort of have a split personality right now where they are still very much at the sidelines at games. And then they have this competitive aspect that a lot of people don't know about and don't pay as much attention to. There's actually one school, the University of Maryland, that did decide to split them up. So they made a competitive team that's varsity, counts towards their Title IX totals. And then they have a spirit squad that goes to games.
And it's interesting. It's kind of fun. At the end of the book, you have a glossary of terms where awesome is a noun. What's an awesome?
An awesome is a stunt where the guy throws a girl up in the air and catches both her feet in one of his hands and just sort of balances there.
And then the opposite of an awesome is an eat mat.
And eat mat is when someone falls and no one gets there in time to catch them and their face sort of goes toward the mat. And that's the worst thing that can happen. Most coaches will have everyone on the team do 50 push-ups if that happens.
Oh, my goodness. Do you have a favorite term you learned?
Yes. I really love the term making the castle. And what that means is you made it to nationals because the stage they performed on is actually physically shaped like a castle with turrets and stonework, and it's all very exciting.
It's a really great read by Kate Torgovnik. I practiced that even. The new book is called Cheer, Three Teams on a Quest for College Cheerleading's Ultimate Prize. I know you're reading at a Borders in Columbus Circle in New York today. We'll link to your website because I know you're doing readings across the country. Good luck with the book.
Thank you.
The new novel, Blood Kin, is set in an unnamed country where a president has just been overthrown. The political landscape is in chaos. But the book deals with the personal fallout for the people who had served at the president's pleasure. NPR's Jeffrey Freimanwire reports that author Kara Dwynne Dovey brings an anthropologist's eye to her writing.
Like the country in which the action takes place, the characters in Blood Kin are never given names. The principal narrators are identified only by their relationship to the ousted president. His portraitist, his chef, and his barber tell their stories as their lives and their influence are shaken by the coup.
I was more interested in people who worked for a corrupt president, but in a non-political capacity. So they're not his speechwriters. They're kind of removed, one step removed from the workings of power. And I just thought it would be interesting then to explore more abstractly this idea of power and contamination.
The South African first-time novelist Kara Dwynne Dovey shows how the narrators have helped to prop up the president's power through their duties. Early in the novel, she describes how every 2 months, his portraitist creates a new work, which will hang in the Parliament building.
I always mixed my palette before he arrived. I knew the shade of his skin, the hue of his hair, the pinkness of the half-moons in his nails. After he'd arrived and was seated, I'd adjust the colors slightly according to his mood. If it had been a bad week, his skin tone needed more yellow. If he was feeling benevolent, I added a daub of blue to the white for his eyes.
The narrators concentrate on their jobs, seemingly oblivious to the details of politics, until the coup, when they're taken into custody with the president at one of his palaces. They begin to fall back into their familiar roles, but this time serving the rebel leader known as the commander.
As someone who'd grown up in apartheid South Africa, I'd always been interested in, you know, how people are complicit in these regimes, even if they are opposed to them, and my parents were. But we were still beneficiaries of that system. And so for a while, I think I was trying to work through my own accountability for what had happened.
When apartheid ended and the country was trying to remake itself, empowerment projects were set up as a way to help give opportunities to black South Africans. Kara Dwynne Dovey made a documentary film about one such project while she was studying anthropology and film at Harvard as an undergraduate. The film looked at labor relations on a post-apartheid wine farm.
They were claiming that workers were being given a percentage of the profits or part of the land to grow their grapes on. They were giving houses, owning their own houses for the first time. So I wanted to see if these claims were real or not. So that's when I went off and lived on the wine farm and kind of tracked the process.
The documentary that she made was called Aftertaste, and she did see people's lives actually improving on the farm. After Dovey graduated from Harvard, she returned to school in Cape Town and earned a Master's of Creative Writing as she wrote Blood Kin. She says she purposely avoided writing a work that could be seen as thinly veiled autobiography.
I have to say, it's pretty unusual for a first-timer to do that, and it was a challenge that I set myself. I just didn't want to write that book about growing up on a farm in South Africa.
In fact, Blood Kin is deliberately not set in South Africa. It could be any country at all. The novel looks at political power and intrigue from the vantage point of those along its edges, The stories of most other fictional tyrants, like the one in Gabriel Garcia Marquez's Autumn of the Patriarch, have been told from the ruler's point of view. Dovi is now at NYU studying anthropology again, pursuing a PhD. She says fiction writing and anthropology are both fertile places for the imagination.
I think all writers are ethnographers of sorts, and so it's a similar impulse, the observational impulse that, you know, writers and anthropologists are trained to have. And, you know, Clifford Geertz talks about thick description for ethnographies. I mean, he's talking about nonfiction, but I think a similar kind of layering of detail is what makes good fiction really good.
Blood Kin is being published in 11 countries. The cover of the American edition features a blurb of praise from Nobel Prize-winning novelist and fellow South African J.M. Coetzee. But Dovi, whose father is an academic and mother is a literary critic, is not so easily labeled.
You know, my dad always used to say to my sister and I when we were quite young, like, you girls are going to have 6 or 7 careers, you know, in your lifetime. Not just different jobs, but different careers.
Anthropologist Caradwyn Dovi plans to study the politics of climate change, tracking how societies respond to enormous upheaval. Novelist Caradwyn Dovi plans to continue exploring the complex web of human behavior in fiction. Jeffrey Fryman Wire, NPR News.